There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is My Wardrobe Malfunction, the podcast that's all about clothes and nothing about clothes, if that makes any kind of sense. This is the fourth episode of season six. If you haven't found us before, scroll back through our previous guests and you'll hear Tan France on his wedding day sacrifice, Stacey Dooley on shivering her skirt off, and Dan Snow on his Indiana Jones hat, of course. But let's get on to today's guest. He's a modern furniture restorer, upcycler, eco-designer, and presenter on the hit show, The Repair Shop, and Money for Nothing, and now Jay and Dom's Home Fix. It's Jay Blades. Oh, of all my amazing guests so far, I think Jay is the most particular about his clothes, and he has an extraordinary life story too. In fact, we talked for so long that we've split this episode into two parts. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. So my guest today is someone who, if you haven't seen and fallen in love with already, you've been living under a bloody rock. It is the wonderful Jay Blades, modern furniture restorer, upcycler, eco-designer, and presenter on the hit show, The Repair Shop, and also Money for Nothing, and now Jay and Dom's Home Fix. Is there anything you're not doing, Jay, when it comes to home improvement?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. With regards to home improvements, I think I've almost got it covered. There's probably about three more shows that I'm doing this year that will make me have the whole holistic approach to sorting your house out.
I had a look at your website, J & Co, and kind of I'm actually in my bathroom at the moment because I've got all my bloody kids here and they're, you know, on doing homeschooling. So it's the only sanctuary I've got left. But I love antique furniture predominantly, but I just, what you're doing to really kind of mainstream bits of furniture is quite extraordinary. And I love the way you paint a little red tip on one of the legs of the chairs and the fabrics you're using. Who does all that? Is that you or is it the kids you're mentoring?
Well, basically, I'm not mentoring as many kids in my workshop as I would like to.
Okay.
A lot of the kids I mentor at the moment is done via Zoom or phone calls. The designs I come up with, I do some of them when I'm in the area, in my workshop, but I've got a team of upholsterers that just knock out the work for me, basically, because sometimes when I'm filming probably about 5 or sometimes 6 days a week. The repair shop is quite intense. And then I have like Money for Nothing on top of that. So I might do 3 days on Money for Nothing and then another 3/6 days because it's one more, 3 to 4 because it's a traveling day as well is what I need. So it's quite intense. I don't get that much time to be in the workshop, but when I'm in the workshop, I do a lot of stuff in there. I dance,
yeah.
I drink a cup of tea, I have a biscuit, and then I just get creative. It's unbelievable. I love it at the moment.
Is that your favourite place to be, in your workshop, more than in the studio or anywhere else? Is that your sanctuary?
My sanctuary is my workshop. My workshop is one of my most creative places to be in the world. I've been loads of places, but when I'm at the workshop, the first thing I always do, I put on a kettle, have a cup of tea, 2 boiled eggs, and then I just put on the music and I start dancing. And when I dance, sometimes I lose about an hour and then I get into it. And when I get into it, I feel the fur come up on the back of my neck and I'm like, that's the one. And then sometimes I create a design, I do something and it doesn't look good and no one gets to see it. But I learned from that design. And most of the designs that I do, you mentioned about the paint on the bottom of a leg or a button, all of those came from mistakes. So I love making mistakes.
Okay, well, we certainly learn from them, don't we? But do you have, I mean, I think you're something like the 44th guest I've had on My Wardrobe Malfunction, and I've had everyone from Nile Rodgers to Trini and to Dame Zara DeRose. But having kind of looked you up and read more about you, I don't think anyone is obsessed with clothes as you are.
I am, I've been obsessed with clothes since I was about 11 years old. And it all started from I got this secondhand cashmere jumper from one of my uncles, and I loved it. I mean, absolutely loved this jumper. It felt beautiful, and it just looked beautiful when you had it on. And my mum decided to wash it, and when she washed it, it came out the size of an action man. And I vowed at 11, I said to my mum, please do not wash any more of my clothes. I'm going to take care of it. And she looked at me like, really? And then ever since 11, I've been washing, pressing, and folding my clothes, and really looking after them. Like you, as almost as if that is the last piece of clothing I'm going to have. And I still have that same kind of attitude towards clothing now.
That's so interesting, because Nile Rodgers is the same. He hand washes every item of clothes, even his suits, and he does it himself. Nothing goes to the dry cleaners. He comes off stage and he puts a suit in the bath with some kind of, I don't know, Lux or fairy snowflake, soap flakes, washes everything by hand.
Wow. I don't...
So it's a thing, Jay.
I don't wash my suits by hand. That's really impressive, I must admit. He's got it worse than me. I couldn't do that. but I do love pressing. I think I spend about 4 hours ironing.
Really? How often?
I could probably do it once a week. I spend the time ironing, because I normally wear a white shirt on the repair shop, mm-hmm. and all of those need ironing. So I just make sure that they look as crisp. I'm very particular. I did do sending my shirts once to an ironing service, and they didn't do it to my standards. So I just said, okay, I'll do it myself. It just didn't work out. So yeah, my standard of ironing is very, very particular.
Very exact. But do you have one of those, you know, I don't know if I've still got one, because we've got a very old ironing board here, and it has one of those little miniature sleeve ironing boards that pull out from underneath, and you put the sleeve of a shirt in so you don't get a crease. Do you have one of those?
I like the crease. So the crease has to marry up to the shoulder. And then you iron the shoulder bit. First of all, I'll take you through the ritual. First of all, I do the collars.
I do
the collars first, and I iron the back of the collar all flat. Then I fold it in the iron inside, just in case the iron has a bit of dirt or something on it. And then I go to the cuff, because I wear a double cuff shirt. So I go to the inside of the cuff, fold it over, and then still press the inside so it's nice and crisp. Then I would press the sleeve. And then once I'm pressing the sleeve, I do it without the button being attached. And then I button it up, the button on the sleeve. And then I turn it over and press the other side. I repeat the process on the other one. Then I do the top of the shirt, which is that bit there, just by the collar. And then I put...
Which is the hardest part.
It is quite hard, but there is a knack to doing it. And then I do... the body of the shirt, and make sure I get the seam, the crease right where the back meets the front, and then I turn it over and put it on the back, and then I put everything onto hangers, or I fold them up, and I put I put the plastic that you get when you buy a shirt, so the cardboard inside underneath the collar, and then you've got the plastic inside, and then you've got the bit which holds the button, so when you put them in a suitcase they don't get crushed.
Oh my God, you're a freak.
Just a wee bit. Just a wee
you
bit.
You are a freak. But okay, so I'm really, okay, because I hear you. I kind of hear you. So it's that annoying thing when you fold them up and then they crease again, because folding almost takes more time than the ironing. So that's really interesting that if you have the bit of flat plastic or cardboard that comes in a shirt, and then you can fold it back over that. Is that what you do?
Yeah. Well, I've been folding since I was 11 years old, so I know how to fold without the plastic. The plastic is inside the collar, so that's the bit that keeps the collar upright. Because I like my collars to be covering my neck, and it just needs to sit. Everything needs to sit correct. But lately what I've done is, because when I fold them up, you take them out, you put them on, there's that crease going right down the front. So now I go with my hangers. And then I'm very particular about the type of hangers that I use as well.
Okay, tell me about the hangers. Are they padded?
Yeah, the hangers have to be, I've got different colours for different things. So my cardigans and jumpers will be on like a beige kind of hanger. It's a suit hanger. So the shoulders are quite broad, so you don't get that dimple in the shoulder.
Yeah.
And then my trousers and my shirts are on a mahogany hanger. And the trouser one has a bar across it, so it holds the trousers correctly on there and doesn't crease them. And then all my shoes are polished and put. But every time I wear a pair of shoes, I clean them before I put them back away. So as soon as I'm ready to wear it, I can just grab it, it's good to go, and that's it.
Okay, so how do you organise your wardrobe? Is it all colour coordinated?
Yeah, my wardrobe is colour coordinated from light to dark, and then trousers. I have quite a lot of dark trousers, and then I've got some light ones at the back. I've got like light grey, I've got some light blue, and I think I've got one brown pair. And then I have my suits and my coats, which are on another hanger. So you have the coats at the back, then you have the suits coming forward, and then you have jackets, and then I'll have my cardigans and my like sportswear jackets, you know, just kind of like mucking about jackets. But everything has to be, oh, and tell a lie, all of my jumpers and T-shirts are folded and colour coordinated, and then all of my thermals, so that's the stuff, when you're working at the repair shop, it's freezing. So I've got a load of base layers that I iron, and they're all folded up and ready to rock and roll.
Do you iron your underpants and your socks?
No, not the socks and underpants. I don't go that far. I just iron my long johns and my tops. That's what I iron.
And what kind of underpants? Are you a boxer short man, a cotton short boxer? Because I just bought my husband these. I'm just going to get them. Hang on. Okay, these are literally, if I'd met him and the first time we'd had sex and he'd been wearing this, I would have walked away.
Now those are good.
But they're comfy. Normally he wears kind of, you know, baggy cotton boxer shorts. These are so hideous, but he finds them really comfortable. And as we get older, it's all about comfort. But I think I might start wearing these because there's no VPL.
Those are exactly what I wear. Not that brand.
Really?
I buy my underwear from Marks and Spencer's. And basically, they have the same, I think it's called a midi boxer. Or it's called a trunk. I think it's called a trunk. A boxer trunk.
Yeah, I think it is a trunk, yeah.
Unbelievably comfortable. I mean, it is just, wow. I can't sing enough about them. They are really, really comfortable. I used to wear boxer shorts, but they were very free, is the easiest way to put it.
I hear you.
Those mini trunks are, it's cool. It's like you're getting a hug all day, and you feel comfortable.
Brilliant. That's that. But that is, getting a hug all day is how I feel when I'm watching The Repair Shop. It's so, I was trying to kind of think of one word to sum it up. And to me, the one word that sums that show up is tender.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the repair shop definitely is tender. It's also, there's a number of words that spring to my mind. It's community, family, love, craftsmanship, and caring. It's just the people in front of the camera, you grow to love them, but it's the people also behind the camera that you don't get to see that I think are the unsung heroes, because they put in such a graft to make sure that the show looks as beautiful as it does. And all of the items are just, the stories attached to them are just out of this world. And I can't big up the crew behind it. I'll do that all day, every day. We're good on the repair shop, but it's because we're a massive family.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shot. It's beautifully, beautifully shot. And every piece is even when it's before it's repaired, it's like a jewel. You know, it's like a jewel. It's like you're on a dig somewhere and you're excavating something. And the excitement as well to see how it's going to turn out it's thrilling too. I find it really exciting. And you're willing. It's like you fall in love with this object. As well as the people, obviously, in the story, but the love you feel for the object as well is extraordinary.
It is unbelievable. And I think we are very fortunate, all of us at the repair shop feel so blessed that sometimes someone brings an item in and the story attached to it is quite raw. Someone might have passed away like 3 months ago. And it's almost as if we feel honoured that they're sharing this story, their family, with us. And the items are not really items. They are like family members because this item that they're bringing in, it's like if it belonged to someone who's passed away, then what happens is they feel really bad and guilty that they've allowed it to get to that state. But once it's repaired, it's almost as if they've got that family member back with them and they feel so proud, so honored. And then the legacy can just live on again. And that is, I've been in some arrivals and reveals that are just... just absolutely beautiful. And I love that the staff or the crew at the repair shop work with me because I'm dyslexic, can't read that well. And basically, they never tell me. You can get a one-pager and they'll tell you who's coming in, what the item is and what it's all about. And I never read it. All they do is say to me, the person's name is Joanna and here she is, Jay. And then when she comes in, we do it all in a one take. And I'm just nosy. I just ask the questions what's the item about? And then the whole point is to make the person feel at ease because if you've got six cameras pointing at you and then you have the possibility of remembering that there are potentially 6 million people watching you, it can be quite nerve-wracking. So my job is just to make them take it nice and easy, just relax.
This, I think it's extraordinary how, you know, when I kind of think back to the shows Trini and I did, how I was always amazed how, actually the reverse almost, how safe people felt in that environment and how willing and keen they were to tell their stories. Yeah. And, you know, and it's the things that would come out. And it's the same with the repair shop. It's like, you know, for you, it's objects and furniture and musical instruments are a conduit to people being so truthful and honest about themselves, about their lives, about the people they love. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's totally incredible. I think, as I said, I think all of us feel so honoured to be part of a beautiful show like that. And then also to be working with just the general public, these guys and girls that come in, it's just like some of the stories attached to an item, you cannot even imagine this. And there's some things that have come in that you just like, wow, really? That's a super history to have in your family. I wish I was part of your family because I'll be talking about that every day. And it is so, so nice. And then We're a great team. We've all become like family members now because we've been working with each other since 2017. And we have breakfast together. We stay in the same hotel. Then we have lunch together. Then we go back to the hotel and we have dinner together. And it's the same thing. You're doing that 5 to 6 days a week. I guarantee you're going to fall in love with the people. It's just like, the way it is.
Absolutely. I mean, I totally agree with you. It's the crew and the researchers, producers who, for me, were always, always like family. And I still have so many friends from making shows all over the world in Israel and Scandinavia who are still really dear friends. And so lucky, so lucky. But let's go back to the beginning because your life has had more twists and turns than a bloody corkscrew.
It has actually. But the beginning, I was born and bred in Hackney, and grew up with my mum and my brother on a council estate in Stoke Newington stroke Clapton. It was on Caesnuff Road. It was right between the two. And I had a brilliant childhood. I think my childhood for me was idyllic. I just, I wrote a book which is coming out in May. And when you're reminiscing to write your kind of autobiography, it's like you go over the stuff of how it made you feel. And I had this, I had the opportunity. I was interviewed the other day by this journalist up in Scotland. And she asked me about something, about a memory I had. And it just triggered something that was so sweet. And I remember going blackberry picking, but there was this story that I told her about. There was a friend of ours. Well, a friend of mine lived in Stamford Hill. And Stamford Hill's got quite, it's quite a big Jewish community. And it was very, not them and us, but we didn't mingle, plain and simple. And there was a Jewish family that had this plum tree in their garden. And my friend lived next door to them and never really got on with them. The ball used to go over in the garden and they never used to throw it back and all that stuff. And then one summer, I don't know what possessed us. We were brave enough to knock on this person's door and say, oh, could we pick some of your plums? Because we see they're just dropping off and you're not having them. And a gentleman looked at us and there was about four kids, four little ruffians from Hackney. And he looked at us and he just nodded like, yes, you go on. And then we climbed on the wall and picked the plums. And I remember just swinging my feet, sitting on the wall, just looking at my friends. And we all just had plums in our hands, plum juice down our tops, and all around our mouth was just plums. And it was just, it was one of the sweetest memories I have of my childhood. But it was just something that was just like, it was based around food, but it was based around, for me, it was based around community. I was sitting there with a community of friends. The Jewish community allowed us to go into his garden, albeit sitting on the wall, and eat these plums. And I remember looking into his garden because you could see he had like French windows. And he looked at us as we were sitting on the wall, just shaking our legs. And he gave this smile that most parents do when the child has done something that you're just proud of, but you know no words could explain how you feel. And he gave us that look, and I never forget that. It was just sublime, absolutely sublime. So my childhood has been, yeah, really cool. But then you've got to go to secondary school, and then secondary school was a little bit...
You say that though, Jay, sorry to interrupt you.
No problem.
Yeah, you say that. You had a pretty shit time too when you... that maybe that was kind of post 11 years old because you suffered bullying, abuse, racism.
Well, basically, I went to a school. My mum decided to send me to a school that was outside of... Well, it was in our catchment area, but it was outside. Not many people used to go to that school. A lot of my friends went to either Clissold Park, Homerton House, or Hackney Downs. I went to Highbury Grove. And Highbury Grove, for me, was my first experience of racism. I grew up in Hackney. We had black, white, Chinese, Asian. We had the whole shebang. I never experienced any form of racism until I went to secondary school and they started calling me some names. And I thought those were names of endearment. I thought they were being nice to me. So when I went back to my community and I started using these names, a lot of the older generation said to me, hold on, Jay, those names are not right. Those are racist names. Where'd you get those names from? Like, we've never heard those names in the 11 years that we've been together. I said, oh, that's what they call me at school.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool. So, an older member of my community came to my school and said to me, point to me who's calling you those names. And I said, those guys. And he decided to beat them up. He didn't go to my school. So when I went to school the next day, I had not only those five people he had beaten up, I had probably about 50 people that were constantly on my case to beat me up. And not only were they beating me up, they were beating up my friend Raja, who was an Asian guy from Hackney, and basically they would beat him up as well. And it wasn't nice. And I spent the rest of my, I think it was 4 or 5 years at school, just fighting racist people, because I got a bit of a reputation of he's the guy to pick on. And anybody that was saying anything racist within the school, I will have a fight with them, trying to defend people. And the punishment I received from my housemaster, my assistant head teacher, and also the head teacher was, wow. I went to school when they was still allowed to cane you, but you had to go for a series. So the housemaster I'll get sent to, he would normally punish you with a slipper. And it was those old plimsolls that used to have the elastic over the top. He cut the fabric off, so he just had the rubber sole, and he would beat you with that. And if you didn't cry or show enough remorse, he would send you to the assistant head, Mr. Morgan. I'll never forget that guy. And Mr. Morgan was ruthless. Mr. Morgan would hurt you, plain and simple. He would hurt you. With what he did with that cane, it hurt. But if you still showed no more remorse, you get sent to the head teacher. You'll get beat. And then on the back of that, growing up as a teenager, growing up in Hackney, was the time of the SPG vans and the sus law, where basically the police only had to suspect that you were doing or going to do a crime, and they will stop and search you, sometimes throw you in the back of a SPG van, beat you up, and then throw you out in an area that was predominantly white. So if you're a black person going into an area that's predominantly white, you have to navigate your way through people not liking you. So yeah, it was twists and turns, I must say.
When you think back to that, what's the kind of most prominent emotion? Is it rage? Is it resentment? Is it forgiveness? Is it, what do you feel when you think back to that?
I've had quite a lot of stuff happen to me, and I am really fortunate to be in the position that I'm in now. And I think the position that I'm in now has been because of what I've received in the past. So growing up poor, growing up and dealing with a load of racism, growing up and dealing with a lot of rejection because of the colour of my skin, has made me realise that, you know what? People really and truly all want to belong to a community. That's basically what it is. And how can I, when I found my calling, I'd done some volunteering work in Oxford. When I found that calling of giving back, that's what made all of the sense to me. It made perfect sense to give back to people who are less fortunate than yourself and start to teach people about the differences we have in society. That was basically my calling. And I would not have been any good had I not suffered the amount of racism that I received growing up and the amount of rejection. So I don't have forgiveness. I don't have resentment or any anger towards what's happened to me. It's just one of those things is the way I see it. It's like it's allowed me to be a really rounded person now that, rather than have, and I'm not saying people who have a chip on their shoulder shouldn't, but rather than have a chip on my shoulder, it's like I need to move forward. And as I need to move forward, I can't move forward with the baggage that you gave me. I never gave myself that baggage. I remember that child that was sitting on the wall eating those plums with the juice going down the front of the t-shirt. It's like, that's me. That's the baggage I have. And I have some beautiful memories growing up. So if someone gives me their baggage, which is racism, I have a choice to either accept it and take that with me or just say, no, I'm going to leave that with you. And that's what I've done, basically. I always deal with, I've done a lot of work in children's homes, prisons, and so on and so forth, working with some of the most disruptive, hard to reach, and uncontrollable people in our society. And I always did it this way for two reasons. One, because I'm dyslexic, and two, because I think I didn't want to read people's paperwork. So normally when you work kind of in the social services sector, or yeah, social services, you get a file about that thick of this young person, this case. And I would never read it because it was written by different personality or different professionals and so on and so forth. I would always take someone on face value. So how they deal with me right there and then is how I'm going to deal with them. And basically, that allowed me to then get to know that person on a basis of I'm going to get to know you. And that has always worked for me. And by doing that, it stemmed from the racism I received. If I went and worked with someone, which I have done, I've worked and trained the police. I've been beaten up by the police. So if I brought that baggage of all police are bad, all police are going to beat you up, all police are racist, full stop, I wouldn't be able to work with them. I wouldn't be able to get them to police the community better than how they policed me. I need to go there with a clean slate and say, all right, I'm going to work with you guys. I'm going to show you how to do it. And if you make some changes, brilliant. If you don't, okay, it's a lesson learned. But in the case of the police that I work with, they made some changes and they done some things that restored my faith in what I'm doing. So it's kind of everything I've had has been a really good experience, even the bad experiences.
And do you think fame protects you to a certain degree from racism?
Never. It doesn't. It gives you more. It gives you more. I have had some trolls, and I must admit that I would say that, I can explain it, that the opportunity of being a celebrity gives you more exposure to people that don't necessarily think you deserve to be in that position. So some people will believe, like, well, why have we got Jay on the repair shop? He does nothing. He's a black geezer. You just got him as the token gesture, etc., etc. Now, for me, it's you're going to get loads of comments like that. You're going to get loads of negativity. I think when you look at the grand scheme of things, and I say this to the people in the repair shop, the experts, because they often come to me and say, oh, some people said this comment about you on social media and this one said that. And I said, look, we've got about anything between 6 to 7 million people watching the show. If you have, and it isn't the case, if you have 1 million people on social media, then you have, let's say, 10 of those million people that don't like me. In the grand scheme of things, that's like a mosquito in the world. Like, that's nothing, really. They're watching the show, which is great. And also, they're allowed to express their opinion. Some people are not going to like you. And it's because of how they've been brought up, the attitude that they have, and so on and so forth. It's just another form of ignorance. Until you've learned about someone's race, someone's culture, or why someone is there, everybody is that owl on TripAdvisor. Everybody has an opinion. And I think with the rise of social media, with the rise of just people being accessible, everybody can make an opinion and they can say. So me being a quote-unquote celebrity or being famous has not stopped the rise of racism. It's heightened it even more, I would say. But it's cool. I would never take on board I never take on board people's attitudes. That's their attitude. And I don't know what their upbringing has been. I don't know what their family members are like. I know my family members. I know how I was brought up. And I was brought up in the sense of do unto others what you want done unto yourself. So if you want someone to treat you bad, treat them bad. And then the karma's going to come back to you. But all of the work that I've done, all of the young people I've supported, all of the homeless guys, people in mental institutions, it's that karma of me giving back is just coming back to me. And it's a really beautiful feeling to just hold your arms open and just say, thank you. Sorry, I bang on sometimes.
No, it's really interesting because, it resonates so much with me in terms that I'm in recovery. And AA is very much about giving back to help you with your own recovery. And to, you know, come to terms with the damage you've caused through drinking. So I really, you know, it really resonates what you're saying. And I think And also, it's like, I mean, I just, thinking back to your school days, that if everyone did want revenge, which, you know, it's only human, the best form of revenge is success. And so you are, you know, you just get on with it and live your life. And
yeah,
you've done bloody well.
It's taken a long time for me to become quote unquote successful in the sense of how people will view success, being on TV and you're doing shows. But I think navigating my way through my childhood, through my teenage years, that is a level of success that kind of goes underrated, because there is a lot of trials and tribulations that you go through that you don't necessarily get a chance to celebrate those. They're not celebrated in the same way of you've got an A-star plus in your GCSEs, you've got a degree now. But surviving in the world that I survived in, that level of success has prepared me for anything. I mean, like being on a repair shop, being on a successful show, having a production company, meeting people that I never anticipated I would meet in my entire life. My community has shaped me to become a social chameleon and someone that has, what is it, an empathy. What do they say on it?
Empathy.
Yeah, I've got an empathy to just tune into to people. And that all came from my community. It hasn't come from any qualifications that I've gained in anything. It's come from the inner me. I give props to my success of surviving and getting out of the community. And now I want to give back in more ways than one.
I think trauma of some kind makes you a more empathetic person, I believe. And I look at kind of the young generation, my kids, for example, and other kids who, you know, are kind of protected quite rightly and loved now, especially by the paternal love, which was almost frowned upon in our parents' generation, certainly with me. And it's like they go through life in this bubble almost, but trauma will come to them because it comes to everyone. And they are going to be so ill prepared. So, for example, my mum was severely manic depressive and tried to commit suicide. And and it taught me, you know, I am so grateful to her for giving me the strength to take on life's challenges and to be more understanding of other people. And in the same way with my alcoholism, which my children witnessed, and I said it was a fucking shit time, and I can't turn the clock back. I can only make amends by staying sober. But it will give you strength. You know, you had to deal with a lot of shit and, you know, hold on to how you got through that and how you came out the other side.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you. I think trauma in all its shapes and sizes, it's one of those things that, it's like what I said earlier with regards to learning from mistakes. When you make a mistake, when you learn from that, it's the best lesson you can ever get. It's called life skills or life lessons. And those life lessons are, I think, preparing you for an opportunity that you never anticipated was coming. Now, I fell down about 5 or 6 years ago. My marriage broke down, my business, my charity. There was a number of young people I had employed. I was a pillar in the community that people used to go to and ask for support in more ways than one. And when you hit a certain point in your life that you need to ask for help, and you're what, in my position, I was someone who was super strong for everybody. But then I couldn't ask the people who I was strong for to help me build me up. It's like, it's impossible. It's almost as if you ask them that and they're looking at you like, hold on, if I have to support you, who's going to support me? And the thing that I did was just drive, get away from all of that and just disappear. I didn't even think I was going to see tomorrow. But by coming through all of that, it has allowed me to then realize, like, wow, one, anything is possible. Two, you can reintroduce yourself to yourself. And I know that sounds weird.
I totally get it.
In the past 6 years, I have reintroduced myself to myself And I've kind of caught up to where I needed to be or where I should be, but I didn't know I needed to get there. So growing up as a young kid in Hackney and then to where I am now, I never in my wildest dreams imagined that I was going to be here. But it's such a perfect fit. It's such the perfect time. It is where you're supposed to be. But you wasn't ready for it. You're only ready when you've been through your trauma, you've been through certain trials and tribulations, and all of that will add fabric to what you need to do in this next journey.
Yeah, and for you asking for help and having this sort of conscience about not wanting to let people down, but as we know, it takes a huge amount of strength and courage to ask for help.
Big time. And I did do that 6 years ago. And the first way of me asking for help was to cry. I broke down. I broke down in front of a guy who I call my brother now, Gerald Bailey. And I just cried and cried. And it's the first time I ever cried in front of a man, and a black man at that. And him being the type of person that he is, he just turned around and said to me, "I've got a job for you." So I'm crying in his car. He's got a beautiful car, white leather interior. I hadn't washed for about a week. I'd been sleeping in my car, and I didn't smell very good. And he just said to me while I'm crying, "Yeah, I've got a job for you." And I was like, "Hold on a minute." I said it in my mind. I didn't say this to him. I was like, "Don't you see me crying? I'm breaking down. I've got nothing. Hello. This is me at rock bottom. This is probably one of the weirdest job interviews I've ever had. Like, you're offering me a job." And I'm just like, "What? Really?" And the progression of what he did with regards to supporting me, even asking him for money. I remember the first time I asked him for money, it took me a week to ask him for £100 because I had to build up the courage. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to ask him for it. And this is a very successful businessman. Him giving me £100 is like nothing to him. Me asking for £100 was the shame, the embarrassment, the kind of disrespect I was showing myself is what was all on me, just asking for £100 just to buy some food and survive for that week was a really big deal. And yeah, as I said, it took me a week to ask him. But I asked for help, and it was, he said to me something that's really stuck with me, and it still sticks with me to this day. He said, "You don't have to worry about asking me for money. I'm going to support you until you're ready to fly."
Wow.
I was like, wow. He gave me £100, and I sat in the car and I cried again, because it was like for the first time someone was actually saying, a man that who I admire was saying to me, "I'll support you." Simple. And that was like, wow.
So basically you were effectively homeless for a week, or was it longer?
No, it was about a week. I was effectively homeless for about a week. I lived with him for about 2 weeks, and then he put me to live with his mum and stepdad, who I lived with for about a year and a half. Probably about a year. And it's weird what I'm about to say, but hopefully someone will understand this. But by living with them, they gave me life again. They reborned me. It was almost as if, imagine you're five, you're growing up, you've just been born, and you're up to your fifth birthday, you can experience all of that. That's what I was experiencing at 45. I was experiencing being born again and just like reliving. They would cook me food, they would look after me, I would look after them, and it was the most beautifulest second childhood I had at 45. It was like, you what? Powerful.
Where was your mum at this stage?
My mum, real mum, was in Barbados. And okay. Then my second mum is Gerald's mum. And the only man I've ever called dad is his stepdad. And I asked him if he would do me the honour and allow me to call him dad. And which I did. And he said, "I would be proud for you to call me dad." Absolutely proud.
And your mum, when did she go back to Barbados?
My mum's been back in Barbados for about 20-something years. I think she's been back in Barbados for about 24 years. But I had a 50th birthday last year, and my mum came over for that, and my two mums met each other with my dad, and they hugged each other, and we all hugged each other. It was the most beautiful experience I ever had. And I had the party. Yeah, it was a beautiful. I had a party in Wolverhampton. Really great place. Yeah.
Fantastic, which is where you live, isn't it, Wolverhampton?
Yes, Wolverhampton.
So how did you end up in Wolverhampton?
Well, basically, I got in the car when everything fell down, and then I just drove and drove and drove, and the light started flashing on the dashboard, and that kind of woke me up out of this trance I was in. So I went to the petrol station and put some petrol in, and then I went to kind of like an industrial park, but it was like a retail park where it had like McDonald's and other big stores there. And I remember getting this, I had a double cheeseburger, I ate that, and I just fell asleep in the car. And that's all I did for a week. I just slept in the car. And I did have a bit of money, but the state that I was in, I didn't know what I was doing. I had no form of direction. I had no form of, okay, today is Monday. You're going to go to there and then you're going to do this, you're going to do that. There was nothing. It was basically like sitting in a car and looking at people go past as if I was not part of that society. I was not part of that kind of existence. I didn't exist for a week as far as I was concerned. I woke up towards the end of the week and I realized I had some money in my pocket still. And I was like, okay, there's a hotel over the road there. I'm going to go and stay in that hotel. And that's what I did. And I think once my car was came out of the retail park, it was recognised on the police register or something. My ex-wife had reported me missing. And then they were able to trace me through the number plate. And that's when she got in contact with Gerald, and Gerald came and got me and offered me a job.
That's it for part one. If you enjoyed it, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on your chosen podcast platform. Thanks to Jay, to our house band duo, and of course, thanks to you for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.